Chapter 13, Bringing a Shared Instructional Framework into the Conversation. When we're talking with teachers about their teaching, how can we ensure that the conversation is constructive? As instructional leaders who take our commitment to improving student learning seriously, it's our responsibility to ensure that teachers are challenging themselves, not just explaining themselves and expecting to continue with the status quo. Like many principals, I've had conversations with teachers who seemed more interested in defending their current practices than in finding ways to grow. Even with the most growth-minded teachers, it can be awkward to keep the focus on improvement without becoming overly critical. And the better the teacher, the more hypercritical it can feel to find areas for growth. I've tried countless approaches to helping teachers honestly reflect on their practice and identify ways they can improve, including approaches that worked and others that completely backfired. My most important discovery has been the power of bringing a third party, a shared instructional framework, into the conversation. In this chapter, we'll explore the limitations of opinion-based conversations, and you'll learn how to use your instructional framework as an arbiter to avoid conflict, as well as strategies for handling disagreements about performance. This in-depth discussion of your instructional framework will help make conversations with teachers more rigorous and more constructive with less conflict. Understand problems with opinion-based conversations. In the typical one-on-one conversation after a classroom observation or brief visit, the teacher and instructional leader have differing incentives, even if both care a great deal about improvement. It's in the teacher's best interests to demonstrate competence and end the conversation as quickly as possible. From the teacher's perspective, the instructional leader does not know as much as the teacher about what the teacher needs to do next in order to grow, Danielson 2015. The instructional leader also wants to demonstrate competence, and thus usually makes suggestions for improvement based on what he or she felt the teacher could have done better. This requires a vision for what good practice looks like and how well the observed practice, the evidence from the visit, aligns with that vision. When teacher and instructional leader don't have a clear shared understanding of what good practice looks like, even the most evidence-based conversation hinges on little more than personal opinion. Over-reliance on personal opinion and personal judgment sets the teacher and instructional leader at odds because the teacher's tendency is to strive to demonstrate competence, while the instructional leader's mandate is to identify gaps in the teacher's competence, areas in which the teacher falls short. The more the teacher becomes defensive and resistant to change, the more the instructional leader goes on the offensive and becomes less willing to listen and learn from the teacher's experience. This dynamic undermines the improvement potential of the conversation, but you can avoid it if a shared instructional framework plays the role of arbiter. Use the instructional framework as an arbiter. When teachers and instructional leaders share a common framework defining good teaching practice, conversations can focus on aligning documented evidence with the criteria that the framework lays out. Instead of a tug of war over whether the teacher's practice is good enough, the conversation becomes a process of triangulation. Because the instructional leader no longer plays the role of judge, the conversation can become collaborative and non-confrontational. Of course, instructional leaders who happen to be evaluators are, ultimately, charged with judging teacher practice. These judgments, backed by the evidence instructional leaders have gathered over time and aligned with the instructional framework, are an important means to hold teachers accountable for their performance and ensure that all students have access to high-quality learning experiences. Within a single conversation, though, emphasizing the instructional leader's role as an evaluator triggers teacher defensiveness and inhibits the kind of professionally rewarding conversations that are possible with the high-performance instructional leadership model. With a shared instructional framework in place, a conversation about classroom evidence is essentially a three-way discussion, with the framework serving as the third person in the conversation. The teacher and instructional leader can review the evidence and ask, how does this align with our framework's definition of good teaching? The specific answers the framework provides are a key resource for improvement. We turn now to describing the nature and scope of instructional frameworks. Understand the components of your instructional framework. Your overall instructional framework involves several nested sets of expectations and descriptions of good teaching practice. It's based on sources including but not limited to your teacher evaluation system, professional development, and adopted curricula, which work together to provide teachers and instructional leaders with a set of common expectations for ideal teaching practice. While your instructional framework is a collection of documents and resources rather than a single document, it's essential that its major components are available to teachers in writing. You should have gathered these documents together during the Day 2 Action Challenge, page 22, and you may want to refer to them as you read the remainder of this chapter. Teacher Evaluation Criteria. At the most basic level, the first source of your instructional framework is your teacher evaluation criteria, which may be written into state law or your teacher employment contract. These criteria often include areas such as classroom management, planning and preparation, professional responsibility, and skill in conveying information clearly and accurately to students. Historically, the sources of these criteria have defined them very loosely, within relatively broad categories, leaving administrators substantial discretion in how to interpret and apply them. For example, Washington state law requires principals to evaluate teachers in 8 areas, including, quote, interest in teaching pupils, end quote, without specifying what constitutes interest in teaching pupils, how leaders might judge it, or how they might discern varying degrees of interest in teaching pupils. Washington State Legislature, no date. Beginning in 2009, many states overhauled their teacher evaluation criteria in response to the U.S. Department of Education's Race to the Top grant program, which, in addition to many other changes, resulted in more specific, leveled indicators for teacher performance. National Center for Education Evaluation and Regional Assistance, 2014. Many states and localities chose to use Danielson's 2007 Enhancing Professional Practice, a Framework for Teaching, as the basis for their new evaluation criteria. These clear, descriptive criteria provide teachers and instructional leaders a common language with which to discuss evidence of classroom practice, and because they include explicit, leveled performance descriptors, they can serve as arbiter in discussions about professional skill. The same is true for other modern frameworks that go beyond the satisfactory or unsatisfactory paradigm by providing 4-tiered performance indicators. Thanks to these new tools, our conversations with teachers can focus on the evidence and on facilitating teachers' reflection on practice with regard to the criteria. But formal evaluation criteria aren't the only aspect of your instructional framework. Professional development strategies. A second source of common expectations is your school or district's history of professional development, which may include specific instructional strategies that staff have been trained to use. For example, when I was a new teacher, my district ran a multi-year professional development initiative across all subject areas and grade levels to train teachers in using specific literacy strategies. When professional development strategies become district-wide expectations, they can serve as excellent reference points in instructional conversations. In order to serve as part of your instructional framework, though, instructional strategies need to meet several criteria. First, all staff must receive thorough training in a clear set of common strategies. Second, the district must clarify and communicate expectations for using the strategies. Third, and most crucially, the district must develop leveled performance indicators. Otherwise, instructional leaders and teachers will focus on quantity rather than quality. The more administrators require the use of specific strategies without attention to quality, the more teachers will be incentivized to engage in gamesmanship, to show observers what they want to see, without making good use of the strategies the rest of the time. Quality indicators can be as simple as teacher-developed rubrics for each strategy. Unlike overall evaluation criteria, leveled performance indicators for instructional strategies can be extremely specific and lend themselves to the evaluation of individual lessons or segments of lessons. Adopted curricula. A third source of common expectations, which may not apply uniformly to all staff, is adopted curricula. Many literacy and mathematics programs, for example, require specific approaches to instruction that differ in important ways from typical approaches. While these expectations will be relevant only to teachers in certain grades and subjects, they are among the richest available reference points for instructional conversations because they're so specific to what educators are teaching and how they're teaching it on a day-to-day basis. Particularly when teachers are learning new approaches, it's invaluable to discuss their practice with instructional leaders and triangulate classroom evidence with the leveled performance descriptors in their curriculum guides. Regardless of the origin of a shared expectation in your instructional framework, it's inadequate to focus on whether you've observed specific behaviors. Instead, your focus should be on the quality or level of performance you observe, and that's why it's so important for an instructional framework to distinguish between varying degrees of proficiency and quality. If your current expectations for teaching practice don't include leveled performance descriptors, start working with teachers at the team or staff level to develop rubrics for practice. You may find it easier to establish rubrics during professional development so teachers can distinguish between poor, mediocre, acceptable, and exemplary practice as they learn about a new strategy, rather than after they've been implementing it, perhaps poorly, for some time. Finally, it's essential to clarify the circumstances under which teachers should use a given strategy. While we often pay attention to whether teachers are using preferred strategies, and we sometimes consider the skill with which they use them, we too seldom consider when they're appropriate and when they're not. When I was a new teacher, I would learn new strategies in weekend professional development sessions and then use them in class the following week for no reason other than that I thought I was supposed to apply what I was learning. A clear vision for instructional practice should provide teachers with clarity about their options for meeting students' needs, not a laundry list of strategies to implement. Make sense of the instructional framework and grain size. A robust instructional framework doesn't always lend itself to use in brief classroom visits because many of the nuances that allow us to distinguish between varying levels of performance aren't directly observable. We can only explore them through evidence-based conversations. While it's common for districts to require administrators and other instructional leaders to conduct classroom walkthroughs with observation checklists or other instruments, this approach differs in critical ways from the high-performance instructional leadership model. When we observe teachers, a checklist of the behaviors and strategies they exhibited is among the least useful types of feedback we can provide. Instead, use your instructional framework to discuss quality, the teacher's level of performance, based on specific evidence and with attention to grain size. Grain size refers to the appropriate unit of analysis for a given element of an instructional framework. For example, some overall evaluation criteria cover the teacher's practice over the course of the entire year, such as professional behavior and communication with parents. The rubrics, such as Danielson 2007, that address such aspects of practice are not intended to produce judgments based on a single incident or even a small number of incidents. They're designed to evaluate the overall pattern of the teacher's practice. It's a mistake, therefore, to use year-long evaluation rubrics to judge the quality of individual lessons. For curriculum-specific instructional strategies, the grain size may be much smaller, and it may be entirely appropriate to evaluate the quality of, say, a mini-lesson in a literacy class based on an ultra-specific rubric in the curriculum guide. For individual instructional strategies, the grain size may be even smaller. For example, a leader can assess the practice of using proximity and eye contact to deal with student misbehavior rather than resorting to verbal reprimands in the few seconds that it takes the teacher to notice misbehavior, make eye contact with a student, and move closer to the student while continuing the lesson. Grain size matters because it's critical that we evaluate the various elements of practice when we have an appropriate amount of information, not prematurely, as we're often tempted to do when we face the considerable time pressures common to our work. The concept of grain size also helps us recognize the vast amount that we don't know about the teachers we work with. A teacher who fails to clarify the purpose of a lesson on one observed occasion is not necessarily a teacher who always makes the same mistake. The teacher is the best judge of his or her typical practice. If teachers are to be the primary evaluators of their own practice in our instructional conversations, what role do we play as instructional leaders? Our role becomes one of facilitating the conversation to keep it on track, to keep it close to the evidence, and to keep it honest with regard to the levels of performance we're seeing. In your third cycle of visits and beyond, a conversation might go like this. After visiting a classroom, you share your written, ideally typewritten, notes with the teacher, so you both have full access to the evidence about what took place in the classroom. You then ask genuine questions about the evidence. See the sample questions in Chapter 12, page 105, and engage the teacher in conversation about how the lesson went relative to the teacher's own expectations. When appropriate, you link specific evidence from your notes to the criteria in the instructional framework, while keeping the issue of grain size in mind. The teacher may identify aspects of the lesson that he or she could have approached differently, and may identify action steps to take before the next visit. Or you might make suggestions to guide the teacher's reflections or provide ideas for next steps. If the teacher cites evidence for a certain performance indicator, you should ensure that the evidence fits the level of performance that the teacher has identified, and guide the teacher to an honest and accurate assessment of his or her practice. Will this result in clear follow-up steps and a satisfying sense of closure? Not always. The nature of professional conversation is that it's ongoing, just as you may have ongoing conversations with family members that don't reach a resolution or result in action-oriented decisions each time you discuss them. Respecting the professional nature of teaching as a process of exercising professional judgment requires that we allow for the possibility that some issues will remain unresolved. These open topics can lead to even richer subsequent conversations, resulting in decisions that are ultimately more accurate and more effective in improving performance. Learn strategies for handling disagreements about performance. What if a teacher reviews the evidence you provide, reviews the relevant aspects of the instructional framework, and arrives at an inflated view of his or her own practice? This is a very common and rational response. After all, evaluations can have a real impact on teachers' employment status. A few basic strategies can keep conversations on track, even when the teacher is exaggerating his or her level of performance relative to the instructional framework. As a starting point, we must recognize that teaching is a complex, long-term endeavor, and not something that only occurs in a single class period while an observer is in the room. While the evidence we gather during our visits to classrooms is a critical foundation for our conversations, it doesn't tell the complete story. So we must approach our instructional conversations with a degree of humility and openness. To put it more bluntly, we should always be open to the possibility that our harsher judgment is wrong and that the teacher's rosier self-assessment is right. We must also help teachers recognize that they don't have total knowledge of how their lesson went and what each student experienced. We may have noticed weaknesses in the lesson that the teacher was unable to see in the moment. Closing the gap between teacher self-assessments and our judgments is a matter of sharing information and perspectives through conversation and written evidence. That's why it's so critical to take detailed notes and to share them with the teacher to establish a common understanding of the basic facts. Then, when you start to discuss the evidence, you can make purposeful use of specific terminology from your instructional framework to guide the teacher toward your perspective. For example, if you're discussing higher-order questioning strategies with a teacher who believes she possesses exceptional skill in this area, you can use terminology from your framework's descriptions of satisfactory and distinguished practice in the area of questioning, and it will become clear in the course of your conversation which descriptors best fit the evidence. Even so, how can we determine whose judgment we can trust in any given situation? We should recognize that we don't always have enough information to address a certain criterion. We may wish we had perfect information on our entire framework, but often we'll have just a fraction of the information we'd like. If we do have enough information to draw conclusions about the teacher's level of performance with regard to specific criteria, it works best to identify the level of performance and then pull specific instances from your written documentation to serve as evidence. This may require several attempts, and in the course of your conversation, you may realize that the teacher was right, or the teacher may realize that you were right. Either way, it helps to use the specific, leveled language of your framework as much as possible, because this will aid in triangulation. For example, if you're triangulating your conclusion that a teacher is distinguished in Danielson's 2007 Domain 2 Component D, Managing Student Behavior, you may want to use terms such as proactive and subtle throughout your discussion, as these terms appear in the distinguished column of the rubric. If you can't come to agreement on a final rating, that's fine. Keep in mind the grain size issues discussed previously. You don't need to evaluate teachers on their final evaluation criteria after every visit. That will take multiple observations and conversations over the course of the year. If you remain in disagreement, let the teacher know where you stand, communicate that you understand that the teacher's perspective differs, and don't try to force a resolution. Day 13 Action Challenge. Use instructional framework language. Return to the various evaluation documents, professional development programs, curricular resources, and other sources that will contribute to the shared instructional framework that you gathered on day 2. You'll want to bring these documents with you as you converse with teachers during your third round of visits. In the meantime, as you make your first two round of visits, talk with teachers about what you've observed in their classrooms, start to use the language of your framework to describe what you see, and help teachers use this same language in their reflections. You may want to consider the following questions for reflection. What staff professional development has provided us with the most expectations and language in recent months? What specific criteria am I most familiar with and least familiar with? What professional vocabulary drawn from these curricula am I already using? What instructional activities are hardest for me to describe in precise framework language?